morning, Mr. O'Neill. You are live.
Thank you. I'm calling the Budget and Audit Subcommittee meeting for today, January 18th, to order here at 10 a.m. And we'll start with the roll call of board members.
Ms. McKinnon.
Present.
Mr. Kendig.
Here.
Mr. Fogel.
Here.
All are present.
We will do a roll call of the staff in the room.
Sir Alan Weissner, Executive Director. And online we have Donna Keppers, who's our Chief Financial Officer.
Are there any other staff online? That's it. Okay, if there are any members of the public online, please state your name and your affiliation for the record. Great. We will move on to item number 3, agenda approval. I'll look for a motion.
I move the agenda as presented.
For Member McKinnon, I second that.
Thank you. The agenda is approved. Item number 4, any public comments? If there's any member of the public that would wish to make a comment, please do so. You have 2 minutes per person. There are nobody online still, so we will move on to item number 5, prior meeting minutes from October 19th.
I move the prior minutes as presented.
Board Member McKinnon, I'll second that.
The prior meeting minutes are approved. We will now move on to agenda item number 6, new business. We're going to start with A, review of all outstanding ADA loan modifications. So, Alan, if maybe just for, you know, a brief update on the loan modifications, why we did those, and then we can start diving into each one of them.
Yeah. Absolutely. Through the chair, Mr. Fogel, Mr. Kendig, Ms. McKinnon, we initiated loan modifications with the occurrence of the COVID-19 pandemic in the early part of 2020, so starting in the later part of March and April of that year, with several requests. Ultimately, we had a total of 88 loans that were requested for modification, impacting about $198 million of our portfolio, which is slightly less than half of our total loan participation portfolio. Since that time through 2020 and ultimately through 2021, we've been addressing different modifications as they've come off, either requests for deferment of principal, which is the majority of the modification requests we have. In some cases, we have requests for deferment of interest and principal. We have continued to review those modifications, and in some cases, we have current outstanding loan modifications. So out of the 88 and effectively $198 million of our portfolio, we now have remaining effectively 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 loan modifications totaling a principal balance of $54.6 million. And in each case, each one of these modifications or outstanding modifications will be coming back to full principal and interest payments as of, in some cases, early part of April, and then coming up through June and July 1st. So all of them should be coming off of any modification with this year.
Thank you, Alan. Maybe Alan or Tiffany, if you could please go through each loan modification, let us know. Give us a little bit of background on each, because Bill is new to the Budget and Audit Subcommittee. What their loan modification was. Was it principal? Was it interest? Was it both? And then just talk about sort of how it's coming to an end at the end of the summer.
Tiffany, why don't you give that brief summary for the PAS board members?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Anna.
I missed whatever was said right before Alan spoke, so I don't know if that was important that I couldn't hear it.
No, Anna, that was me, Bill Kennedy. I just told him that, you know, I was there when we did these modifications, but I need to get caught up to speed on them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, so starting out with Al Marine, that is the fourth modification. They are a well-watching, primarily tour business, a small boutique cruise ship line based out of Sitka in Juneau. And so that is due to end summer, June 1st, and we have no indications at this time of anything to be different than that. Alyeska Realty.
And they've made all of their payments on time.
Yes, they made all their payments on time, and yes, I sorry, did not say that it is a principal deferment. So they are been making interest payments all this time. And I believe all of these, and I'll have Morgan speak to Blue Crest and Duck Point. Those are under direct. But all of the loan participation ones down to HUNA are all on a principal deferment. So they're making interest payments, and they are all current on those interest payments. Alyeska Realty is a retail establishment, three different retail tenants in Skagway. So again, affected by the tourism. And we did kind of categorize these by what industry really the repayment is coming from, and that's that tourism industry. As you can see, that's what's been heavily hit, and definitely the Southeast region. You can see that's the majority of what is on here as well. Alyeska Realty Advisors, they're on their third modification. It's coming up through June 1st. They are current, and we have no indication at this time that they're going to need any further modifications. Taku Glacier Lodge is out of the Southeast as well. They're coming up March 1st, principal deferment. They are current, and they have indicated to us that they will not be in need of a further modification. HUNA, and they are tied in with Duff Point. And Morgan, did you want to kind of combine those and speak together?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Tiffany. Chairman of Board, both HUNA and which is also under Duck Point, those, as Tiffany said, were on principal deferral. All covenants and requirements underneath those modifications continue to be satisfied, and we just recently met with the team and look forward to seeing how they perform going into this next cruise season. We're very, very happy with what we saw with their financials, and we believe that they're in a great position to take advantage of a full cruise season this year.
Well, so I think, and Alan, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, but I don't expect for a full cruise season for 2022. What are you hearing in the industry? And how that might affect their financials and eventually our loan modification.
At this time, we are not anticipating that there would be any further requests for modification on these loans, again, based upon what the initial indications are for the cruise season. I know it has been impacted by different issues of COVID recurrences and the different series that we have been seeing. However, based upon, again, general feedback that we've received from the companies broadly, not every company, but broadly the companies, is that there's a view that supports no further modifications.
Okay. Anything else on Duck Point?
No, nothing. Again, as Alan has said, we don't expect any further modifications. And we continue to be, they continue to satisfy all of the terms and conditions of their modifications.
Okay. And what I would highlight, too, is Blue Crest is the one outlier on this list, oil and gas.
Correct.
Versus tourism.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've seen a robust comeback on the oil price over the last year and a half. All anticipation, at least forecasts that I have seen, are anticipating further, at least maintaining that oil price level or further increases. So it really comes down to utilization, and then we would have to specifically review and have that conversation with Blue Crest prior to that point in time when it matures.
I'm going to have any committee members that want to ask questions before I ask mine. Anna?
I'm good.
I'm good.
So for some of these ones that certainly stand out, I'm not going to name them, but how often are we in touch with these borrowers regarding their loan modifications and then their overall business health?
Thank you, Chairman. Everyone at least monthly on the loan participation side. Some are more than monthly because due to their commitment for the modification, they have different requirements.
Okay.
So in some cases where they have different financial reporting requirements, we're in touch weekly. But everyone at least monthly if they just have a kind of a set it and forget it type right now. So at least monthly.
And are we in direct contact with the buyer, or do we have to go through the bank to get these answers?
So that's a good question. Typically, it is with the lender. Again, with some of the borrowers, it is direct because some of the borrowers have reached out to us where they want to confirm that we've received what we need, if we need anything going forward. But in most cases, it is going to be the lender since they are a direct client.
And I remember from past meetings, sometimes the lenders weren't real forthcoming with information that we might need.
Mm-hmm.
Have we cleaned that up, or are they aware that we weren't satisfied with some of their responses?
We have communicated since July of 2020 the specific requirements that are the documentation that's required by the underlying underwriting banks to us with each modification. Now, there's been mixed success in achieving that information, though, as you're highlighting. I believe that with new management within the commercial finance director and the oversight of that group, and also the addition of staff that's been reviewing the documents, reviewing the loan service payments as they come through, there's much more interaction with the underlying bank, the underwriting bank. So there's more opportunity to ensure that we are receiving the information we require.
I'd like to, that's important for us to be able to react, you know, the board not getting information at the last minute and making decisions. I'd just like to highlight the importance of we can communicate that to these lenders and maybe quarterly if you can report how that progress is making. And who's the shining stars and who are the problems?
I think, Bill, you'll agree with this. I'm in a relationship business, and so I'm wondering if, on our side, if we're taking care of that relationship, i.e. constant communication, taking them to lunch, doing other types of events with them to feel the love, I would say. Having that connection with Tiffany,
our policies and procedures don't allow us to entertain customers or clients as a state corporation. However, we have been interacting with them really through communication and speaking with the underlying banks and also in certain cases like these, talking directly with the borrower.
Okay.
If I may, excuse one item to address to you, Chair. We do have someone who wants to make public comment who was, I believe, unable to raise his hand at the point in time to get noticed. Are we able to go back to public comment to allow them?
Certainly. Go ahead.
If there are any members on the line that wish to make a public comment, please press star 9 on your phone now. Please clearly state your name and affiliation if you have one. Hello?
Hello, hi, this is Ken Kastner. I was on, the first words I ever heard from you were Duck Point, so I was on but not connected. I'm Ken Kastner. There's two things from the minutes of the last meeting that I'd like to address. First of all, Mr. Weissner stated that the discussion of next year's budget and the prior year's audit should be heard in the executive session. Agency budget document is covered by a very specific state statute that prescribes the exact moment that a budget becomes public. and that's when it goes to OMB. And I have no quibble with that. The audit, on the other hand, is a factual examination of past events. The administration may review the document for misstatements and errors, but when it goes to the board, it becomes deliberative. The public deserves the right to hear the board's questions as well as the auditor's reply. It's not something that it's a public corporation that needs to be done publicly. Second, Mr. Fogel is inconsistent in his summation of executive session activity with the statement that no formal action has been taken on the matters discussed in executive session. You might also say that no animals were harmed. Both are standards, but neither is the standard required by the Open Meetings Act. The Open Meetings Act allows for no action whatsoever, none. No assignments to staff, no building consensus of opinion or reaching a decision to be announced later in open session. In short, deliberating the public's business out of the public sight. It's a specious claim to announce that you did not do what you cannot do. I addressed the issue over a year ago, and the Department of Law is going to have a jolly time explaining to the court why this deception continues today. When you come out of session, either say nothing or say it correctly. But no formal action is just saying we made no motions, which you can't do. I would remind you that you're a public corporation and that the public deserves to be involved in every step of the deliberative process. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Going back to item 6A, are there any further questions for the team for Ada?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Anna.
Thank you. On Otaku Glacier Lodge specifically, I see that the modification will end in March and Duck Point ends in April, and I know that we did have a conversation already about our borrowers understanding their responsibilities. Do we anticipate, with these two borrowers, it's not summertime, and so it just seems a little bit different, and I'm wondering if communicational responses from them have been different.
Thank you. This is Tiffany, Commercial Finance Director. I can speak to Taku Glacier Lodge. We have spoken with the lender and the borrower, and they have indicated that they do not anticipate needing another modification. So they will resume principal and interest.
Thank you, Tiffany.
Board Member Cannon, I would say that those comments are consistent with Duck Point and Luna Totem. There's nothing to indicate that they're going to request an extension of a modification.
And Blue Crest?
Blue Crest is in until July, and at this point they're on interest only, and there's nothing more we can update at this point outside of what we've previously discussed in the confidential session of public financials.
When they say they want another modification, how much notice do they have to give us? 30 days, 60 days, we know, how far in advance do we know that they may ask for a modification?
Typically, we're working months ahead of time with the borrowers, in this case, or the underwriting banks if it's a loan participation. Particularly with these modifications that, as Tiffany highlighted, in some cases, they're on the fourth modification. They're on the fourth, I want to clarify, they're on the fourth modification because some of the earlier periods were set up as 3 months, pretty short to continue to monitor it. And then we got to a point latter part of this year, of last year, to where we extended it through the season. So we're not anticipating, again, that there will be continued requests.
I understand. This is just a general question. So if somebody does ask for a loan modification and it's 3 months down the road, could the board be alerted at that time that we're in discussion, may or may not need it, but we're in discussion?
Certainly. Okay. We can give updates to the board about which ones are currently in discussion at this point.
Okay.
Along that line, Alan, do you think it would be prudent for us to have a policy that if a business is going to request a loan modification, it must be done so or do we already have this in the loan modification language that they must do so within 90 days of the termination of the current modification? Because I know we've gone through this period, and we have done a lot of things sort of hastily because the pandemic made things very, very, very volatile. But should we have a policy that states that if you want to request a modification, it should be done so within X amount of time so that we don't have to go back or have suspended payments?
We haven't formalized the process as in a policy. What we have communicated certainly to the underwriting banks, particularly under the loan participation program, those that we don't handle directly, that we need to have information provided to us on a timely basis. The way that staff has handled this is by defining to the underwriting bank the date that documents are required for us to be able to review. It goes through several stages before you ultimately see it, and that's through the staff's. Initially, would be Tiffany Jansen and her team's review of the information, vetting the information, asking questions, getting feedback ultimately from those parties, to then be able to present it to an investment committee of staff. If it is approved at the investment committee of staff, or in some cases, a approval at that point in time, or under our policies, if it's required to go to the board, it then starts having the information prepared at that point in time. What was occurring, I think, was the situation that you saw previously, is that things were moving so quickly on some of the modifications that there was not enough time period for us to receive the information directly from the underwriting banks because they were just receiving or still waiting for that information from the underlying borrower, but something needed to be addressed. We don't think that that's going to continue to be the case. It's not the way that we address it with direct lending under our 4488-172 program or some of our other funds. And that way we're directly addressing with the borrower, defining to have sufficient information to be able to present that fully to the board at that time. I think our process is working in the way that we're addressing it. I don't believe that we need to state formally in a policy, you are required to give us this information 90 days ahead of time, before the due date.
It would be nice to have something in policy, but at the same time, state in there that it has some flexibility because of things like COVID that are unforeseen. But if we just had a guideline, but it's flexible, but we had a guideline, then they're aware of it, and I think it would make them come to us quicker, sooner rather than wait.
The other element that I would highlight is the occurrences that we had where loans were already in past due when something was being presented, was with different management of the loan participation program. We have not had one of those occurrences with Tiffany Jansen's management.
Okay. I'm just thinking about past, right at the last minute, and either they're going to go down or we're going to do something.
I think along to Bill's point is, certainly personnel has a big influence on what has occurred. I'm hoping that, Tiffany will grow in this organization, hopefully, and hopefully she won't leave us, but what she's doing, we really should be putting into sort of formal policy. So that someone who takes her position, or if she's, God forbid, hit by a bus tomorrow, someone can take over and continue the successful path that she's taken so far.
Like an underwriting guideline maintenance for.
Yeah, we should have underwriting guidelines.
Sure. Tiffany is a force of nature. I would be sorry for the bus.
But, we have it in our business. We have underwriting guidelines that are enforceable. So there's no reason why we shouldn't do that. And I guess that gets into, our item of E.
And not that it's got to be black and white. I mean, it could be flexible because of the circumstances. But just some kind of guideline, okay, this is what we want to do.
Great. Any other questions, Anna?
Not for me.
Awesome. Any any other comments, Alan? Or Tiffany? Or Marvin?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, one comment just for the board's consideration regarding, guidelines with notification on future modifications. I just want us to be cognizant that if 30 or 90 days is the standard that we're looking at applying, as Chairman Vogel, made a comment about his, he's not sure that there's going to be a full crew season. And so that's a very subjective, view. Amongst most people right now, amongst the crew season, whether or not there's going to be a full revenue season for these affected businesses. I'd hate to get us in a position where they're requesting because they have to, because they don't also have that line of sight yet, and then we are bringing it up in the board in a formal or informal fashion, and then we are, we're making a decision without seeing whether or not they're going to have the means in order to satisfy their obligations going forward.
Again, not black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Flexible, sure, with unforeseen circumstances.
Well, in regards to that, Morgan, I would hope that we're in talks with the Travel Association, that we have numbers of how many scheduled cruise ships are to come to Alaska, so that we know, because tourism is a big block of our loan portfolio. So we should know those numbers up front so that we can calculate sort of what the risk is.
Chair, the distinction is that those numbers were at the same level of what was scheduled for 2019 all through 2020. The issue was the cruise ships didn't arrive because of different requirements. Not able to leave ports that were located in Canada, not able to transit ultimately to Alaska waters.
I'm talking about for 2022.
But that's the issue, is that ultimately we are up to date on that information. It is still reflecting a full cruise ship season for 2022. It's what ultimately ends up getting canceled because of something occurring. That's the short-term event that we're impacted by. Just highlighting that the source of information is still going to be there, meaning at the higher level of cruise ship activity, if that's the particular concern.
So they're projecting back to 2019 level?
They're looking at cruise ship activity that's higher than 2019 levels.
So back to higher than normal.
Well, it's interesting. Normal is a relative term in this case.
Well, taking out the pandemic, they're scheduling for a higher cruise ship season than what was in the 2020 pandemic.
Yeah. What was forecasted ultimately in 2020.
Wow. Anna, did you have a question?
Not really a question, Mr. Chairman, but I just wanted to dig up a bit of history for the committee, and that is that when we headed into the pandemic, the board and the subcommittee began to ask for very detailed information from our team that at times we were frustrated that we could not receive or did not receive. And Mr. Weitzner, at our direction, as the board should do, provided high-level guidance on the information that we needed, and it was placed in his realm, his responsibility, to accomplish that for us. And we have seen dramatic change in the information and the timing of that information as it makes its way to the board. And so I just want to remind us that staff does need flexibility, and our job is not to do the executive director's job or the CEO's job, but ours is to provide that strategic planning and guidance. And I just want to say that the staff has done an excellent job in responding to us now. And so if the staff right now is hearing us ask detailed questions that might come from a supervisor, it's because of our past experience that we didn't always get what we were asking for. And so as a former executive director, I want to set a bright line between the board and the administration of ADA. ADA has placed its trust and responsibility in Director Weitzner, CEO, Weitzner, and I have total confidence in his ability. And the team that he has put together for us has just done outstanding work and has been very responsive. And so when it comes specific to outlining a time frame and reports, those are all great questions. And I think that our executive director, our CEO, can provide us those details. But I for one, do not want to hamstring the team that is trying to provide this work. And as Bill said, you know, we do want flexibility, and these suggestions are excellent suggestions in a conversation with the executive director to see if it's best practices for the organization. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Anna. Okay, shall we move on to item number 6B? Again, for our new committee member, maybe go over a brief history of our loan portfolio, sort of talk about the industries that we're in, and sort of historical knowledge about our loan participation in our direct loans.
Certainly, Chair. The report that's before everyone, this loan dashboard report, is a monthly report that we provide to the board at the general board meetings. So the request was really giving a summary of what the balances that we're reporting from January 1st, 2020 to current date. So we were able to fulfill that through an update on this information through December 31st, 2021. Would you please share that with the board? Now, the public has available what we only had at the point in time of providing a linked agenda. Is information through January 30th.
It's different.
November 30th.
Oh.
So we will be updating the agenda for that information for the public to review. But as of right now, it's really talking about the numbers for December, from January 1st, 2020 through to an ending balance of December 31, 2021. Now, what this loan dashboard report does, it summarizes two important things. One is our balance that we currently have in our loan participation program, but it also includes what we have under direct financing, the loans that we have under our 4488-172 program. Two distinct accounts within our statutes, the enterprise development account and the economic development account. But in combination, it represents our loan portfolio of our asset base. So in starting balance, ultimately, collectively, we had loan participations that were $422 million. We had additional bond sale loans, which were about $10.6 million. And then we had power project finance loans, which we are buying from AEA on a recycling basis of capital, that were a total of about $12.6 million, and giving us then a total balance of $445.4 million within the loan portfolio. This then ended the balance as of 12/31/2021. Again, updating information for the public. It's an ending balance of $413,396,402 in loan participations, bond sale loans of $9,194,805, OREO and other loans of only $100,000, an extremely well-performing loan portfolio. Power project loans of $2,938,925, or giving us then a total revolving fund loan balance of $425,633,132. So a net reduction in with principal repayments that come over time and some payoffs that occur within a loan participation program, but having a net payoff in total of about $20 million. From start of January 1st, 2020 to the end of 2021, so 2-year time period.
Thank you, Alan. Can you talk about, first thing I want to mention is that, Bill, for your, since you're new on the board, is that we were never able to end our month ends within a couple of weeks before we had Tiffany, so that's a big success for us. Alan, can you talk about some of the strengths and weaknesses in general terms of our revolving fund, as well as maybe some potential projects or loans that that are coming down the pike, and maybe some concerns that you have about this fund as well.
Well, the revolving fund is our principal loan balance. So when we report our annual financial statements and we have a net position of about $1.4 billion, I'd have to take a look at the specific balance, but I believe our revolving fund is effectively $1.2 billion of that. Again, I'd have to defer to the financial statements, which I do not have in front of me, to define that specifically. But the revolving fund holds our assets that are invested in the loan participation program. They hold our assets that are invested in our direct project developments. It is our principal source of capital, ultimately for our future investment into the state for economic development. So when we talk about our loan participation program, which again has a balance of $422 million, effectively $425 million, the continued new fundings that come under that for, in large part, this commercial, the loan participation program is part of our commercial finance developments. It's focused predominantly on the commercial real estate sector, providing stability within the state. It's broadly diversified across the state. It's broadly diversified across various components of business sectors within our state. So when we talk about building that portfolio, advancing that, we're looking at this year had estimated that we would be adding $60 to $65 million in new loan participation loans. That funding comes from our revolving fund to be able to do that. When we talk about paying Ada's dividend, we announced a dividend of $6.8 million with this year's statutory net income. In aggregate, we've distributed close to over $446 million to the state's unrestricted general fund for social services since the initiation of the dividend. That is paid out of our revolving fund. We have 15 projects, active projects in our project pipeline that have investment requirements that are close to $1 billion. Not all of those are occurring tomorrow. They will be in development. They are under agreements that are coming into force. They have funding requirements that we have either under direct agreements with those parties, or we anticipate we will be coming into agreements that support economic development within the state. That funding, it would be coming from our revolving fund. So this is the critical source of our ongoing funding for economic development within the state. And overall, to conclude that, Chair Fogle, is that ADA has since its inception, directed over $3.5 billion into economic development within the state. We anticipate we will continue to do that with full access of our revolving fund.
Has the pandemic slowed down our new funding of loans? Has it been stagnant? Has it decreased? I'd like to understand, are we generating those new loans each year at a robust level, so increasing the amount of loans that we're giving each year to continue to reinvest into the economic development of Alaska? Are they increasing, decreasing, stagnant?
If you look at the trend over the last 10 years, it has been increasing fairly significantly. So normally we were looking at annual balances of $35-40 million in new loan participations. This year, and I really want to hand it over to Tiffany Jansen to give a little bit of a summary of what growth that she is seeing with it. But we have been anticipating, we budgeted between $60 to $65 million this year in new loan participations. Tiffany?
Thank you, Alan. Yes, Chairman. So looking at these numbers, obviously, the January 2020 to December 31st, 2021 encompasses three different fiscal years. So if we were to divide them out and just look at the calendar, definitely 2020 took a hit than it normally would have, a normal year. 2021 was more of a normal year, and that's...
What was the hit?
We did mostly modifications that year with
dollar-wise,
I want to say, and I'm going to speak ballpark here because I don't have it in front of me, that it was about 10 different new loans.
I know this is tedious, but that's sort of what I'm looking for in this whole analysis, Alan, is making sure that we're continuing to grow our, mm-hmm. our loan portfolio, because that's pretty important, especially with some of our other, our big loan coming off in the next 10 years. We need mm-hmm. to make sure that we're replenishing those.
So definitely in 2021, we were back up to the $60 million range, and we saw an increase in applications. Right now, during the holiday time, the lenders kind of shut down. So for that month of December and the first part of January, it's usually pretty quiet. We have had a delay in applications this month due to severe weather across the state where lenders weren't even able to get to their offices. We had many people across the state were affected by that. That severe weather from the southeast to the Matthew Valley. What I can tell you is that the pre-slice, which is the first step right before we get the loan application packet, in the last couple of months, even during holiday time, which again should be a slow time for us, we've processed 10 of those for over $22 million. So there's definitely things coming down the pike. They're just taking a little bit longer to get to us. Typically, we've seen more packets this week even. But again, that severe weather has kind of delayed people for another couple of weeks.
And I appreciate that. I'm not really looking for the month-to-month. I want to see sort of the big picture. Say, let's take the last 10 years of where we're at for loans. Because I want to make sure, sort of looking into the future, we need to, that number needs to increase every year. And I don't know, Alan, are we putting that into our budget for an increase every year of, 5 to 10%, or what are your thoughts?
We have increased it for the fiscal year 2022. That's the $65 million number that I'm talking about. We did $58 million, mm-hmm. 57.5, I believe, $58 million last year. So all through the pandemic of fiscal year 2020, we did $58 million. We're anticipating through this fiscal year to have increased over $60 million, again, range of $60 to $65 million. So it has been growing. We can show you those numbers that are behind it. One thing, though, that I do need to caution on is that what has happened is that you've had increased value for real estate properties across the nation, and that's because of a much lower interest rate that's been present. So we are also subject to sales that we cannot forecast, that a building owner may choose to sell to a party that has its own financing. We're not looking to openly compete with parties that are looking to invest capital into the state. We're here to support our existing financial sector and make sure that there's patient capital that's for commercial real estate development, long-term equipment development that leads to reinvestment within the state by those parties. We have one particular loan, which is fairly significant, that is going to be paid off as exactly this type of situation. So we're not able to control that.
Well, yeah, what I'm looking more, I'm not looking on the sale end. I'm looking on the underwriting side, is that we're underwriting a certain amount of numbers per year. Plus, we have this great asset of Tiffany out there. Let's utilize her to start being aggressive and going out and getting some of those loans. So it'd be good to see the 10-year look-back period and what's forecasted for 2023 at this point.
And if you need any help in the valley, just let me know. But Wasilla's working on the airport expansion, and they're talking about quite a few different players that want to be at that airport, and they need loans for their infrastructure.
Chairman Vogel, you mentioned something earlier about us taking a proactive stance with customer relationships and service, and I think Tiffany and her team are doing just that, and I think that's exactly what you're pointing out here is our active engagement with the banking community with this program,
mm-hmm.
getting them more familiarized with the program, how ADA can work with them, and onboarding more banks, smaller banks potentially, that don't know about the program to the extent that it is, or maybe have some misconceptions about it. And I know Tiffany and her group are really actively working on clarifying that and onboarding more partners, because there's such a critical need in order to grow that portfolio and to provide, you know, capital and access to that capital to the community of Alaska.
Yeah. You're exactly right. And, you know, Alan, we gave you a pretty big direction as a board a couple of years ago to really revamp ADA. And so you've done that. So now it's time to pivot and start looking forward and how can we grow this organization.
Sure. One thing that you haven't seen yet, because it's on the agenda for the January 27th board meeting, which is our organization chart. One of the reasons why, Morgan, that is part of this meeting is because we have moved the commercial finance group under the chief investment office.
Sounds good.
And it's all part of that. What we're driving is our availability to the state and its borrowers and really being a solution, trying to understand what the issue is, really driving the engagement that's on the commercial finance side of the organization that we're able to know, you know, how best we address the needs within the state. We fulfill the responsiveness that's required in our mission.
That's great. Great news. Thank you. So I think the only thing that, the only item is just a 10-year look back on the underwritten new loans. Any other committee members have any questions regarding our loan dashboard report? All right, we'll move on to item number 6C. This is an item that we have been talking about in this committee for a couple of years now, just looking at our risk, not only in industry, but also regional, and see if we can diversify that risk, or, you know, what are your thoughts? Anna, this is one that you have brought up several times, so if there's anything that you'd like to talk about during this agenda item, I certainly would appreciate if you would speak up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're on developing an appetite for entrepreneurial venture-based economic development.
We're on item 6C, which is the portfolio risk in industry and region.
Well, you can tell I'm biting at the bullet for the next one. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate staff bringing this forward. I definitely think that outlining an allocation and providing guidance to the leadership at ADA would be helpful to protect assets long term. And I'm interested to hear staff's presentation on the documents, and if there are new documents, if someone could email them to me, I would appreciate it.
Alan, if you could walk us through this report, and then if you or Morgan or Tiffany have recommendations, I think it would be valuable.
What we have is information for the board members and then also for the public is breaking down, based upon a reclassification that we've done on the loan participation program portfolio, because this is what it's principally focused on. So previously, we have been in our loan dashboard reports been providing a breakdown by industry sector, which was really determined separately by the loan participation, the commercial finance staff, and it was not representative of standard industry codes, NAISC codes. We went on, we undertook an exercise to refashion the codes, right, to determine that. But we found a limitation on our internal software, which is unfortunately represented in the information that you have in front of you. And it's really to present the information, to talk with the members, to determine what next steps we do to be able to gather the information to evaluate this issue very specifically. What you have in front of you, I don't think gets to the job. because we have a breakdown based on industry codes that aggregates well over half of our portfolio into one sector, which is fundamentally the real estate rental and leasing industry sector, which has total loans aggregating $231 million, or effectively 51.14% of our portfolio. So to restate what the objective was when it was last discussed with the board, was we noted a deficiency that some of our loans weren't being identified due to the underlying exposure that they had. An example was tourism in the discussions on that. But when you go back and do the industry codes based upon the borrower, the way that they've identified their industry code, they are looking at it as a real estate investor who's making their facility available for broadly any underlying party. That's why you have an aggregation now in effectively the specific category of real estate, rental, and leasing. So what I've asked Tiffany and Morgan to do is take a step back and really look at the underlying purpose of the building. What's getting missed here is that, as an example, a doctor may have separately incorporated a real estate holding company to then lease that building back to himself as a single occupancy medical building. Under this classification, we would have noted it as rental real estate, when that's not the case. It's special purpose. Under the previous classification, it would have been identified as a medical office building. So we're now looking at trying to get a combination. To give you more detail, the limitation that we have on our internal software, which, again, the way it was initially put up within the organization, and we are unfortunately fundamentally not able to change that right now, is that we can only list one industry code for the loans. It never anticipated the need to actually evaluate our data. So what we're asking the group here is, what do we concentrate on? How do we follow up on the information to really define and be able to evaluate the industry codes? We know, because this was the principal conversation, we have a concentration in hotels, as one example, within the portfolio. Over $100 million looking at prospective participations within that area. It is a concentration. It is a focus with the state. It is something that is a leading economic development aspect for tourism. We currently do not have the data to be able to really represent that for a cogent discussion. So what I'm asking is, what feedback can we get to get the information ultimately to get a cogent discussion on industry gaps?
Okay. Anna?
If I might, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Board Member McKinnon. Alan, this gives us a perspective on our portfolio, and thank you for giving me the new document that you're looking at right now, dated 1/18/2022. So the technology that we currently have won't let us create subcategories in that leaseholding space from the national standards, correct?
That is correct.
Can we create a report specifically on that category that drops down, or are you pursuing a different way to look at the cross-section of the data?
So, Morgan, you want to give a summary of what we discussed?
Sure. So what we're doing now is we're actually looking to migrate away from any type of manual processes. As everyone knows, that can be very much error-prone and time-consuming. So myself and Donna Keppers, our CFO, are spearheading the process to look at different modules and functionality of our existing system that will allow more robust reporting, which includes breaking down the subsectors to a level that provides more substantive data to the board and to ADA as an organization regarding our risk exposure to certain industries. And then we're also, you know, looking at, you know, the, for example, Anchorage, we're also looking at comparing that to what is their exposure from an industry standpoint, from a, you know, because if we're in line with, let's just say it's hotels in Anchorage and our exposure is at or underneath that, then it's a, you know, it's a good comparison to see where the actual commerce and revenue is coming from the actual underlying community as a basis for our exposure in the loan portfolio. Not saying that that should really dictate our limitation. I'm just saying it should be something that we look at in comparison, especially with all the other communities and cities that we have exposure to within the loan participation program.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So as a follow-up, it's important that we certainly can document our strategies and how we're going to look at this, and I totally understand wanting it to be automatic so that we don't have errors in our data. This national standard, does it interface with labor statistics? So one of, inside of ADA's mission, beyond projects, our underlying goal is economic development, right? And we sometimes measure that frequently, more than sometimes, on how many jobs are created. So can we intersect this particular data structure foundation with the labor market? I mean, does labor use this breakdown for us to intersect with unemployment trends?
Board Member McKinnon, we are actually looking at all of that data because we do believe it's relevant, especially as an economic development authority. And I'll tell you, that's one of the processes we're examining right now, is looking at the different ways data can be pulled into our system, whether it's through FTP, API, or Power BI that ends up generating dashboards. So we believe that those are all things that we'll be able to convey a little bit more thoroughly once we've had an opportunity to actually have a substantial conversation with the consultants that we're looking at potentially engaging in order to help build out the robustness of the platform.
Thank you. Mr. Sherman, my comments would be this: in this first blush look at these dynamics and this perspective, it's good for us to know that 50% of invested assets in round large numbers are in something that's tangible and something that we could recoup our investment from, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm more, at least retrospectively, for investments that should provide Alaskan comfort that this is a yet-to-be-determined project, but it's actually something with an asset that's easily, in most cases, valued. I know I've raised before that it's sometimes difficult to look at vessels and understand the true value versus potential maintenance needs of a vessel. So I like using the national standards, Mr. Chairman, but I do think that we need some subcategory breakdowns. Obviously, tourism has been heavily harmed by COVID and the global pandemic, but medical facilities that have those same kind of building structures, as far as I understand, have been fairly profitable depending on what type of medical structure they are. So it doesn't tell the entire story in just looking across this national code. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Board Member McKinnon. I have a couple questions. The first being, what are some, for risk analysis or risk diversification, have we looked at industry standards for economic development corporations?
At this stage, the answer is no, we haven't looked at it because there's not really a comparable portfolio of this loan participation program amongst different economic development agencies. You may recall ADA is somewhat unique in the way that our statutes have been set up, but because we have very unique requirements within the state of Alaska. So a broader economic development corporation in Montana would not be looking at the same things that ADA is looking at for the state of Alaska. So the loan participation program was something that started back in 1980 with transfers and loans that were originally made by the Department of Revenue. We have since grown that less than $100 million balance to a cycling portfolio now in excess of $420 million.
Yeah.
So it's really driving the commercial real estate sector within providing that patient capital within the state of Alaska. Lower 48, there are other investment entities that focus on commercial real estate development that provide low-cost capital. Those types of institutions, financial institutions, do not participate in the Alaska marketplace. So we have fulfilled that role. So it's very hard to make a direct comparison.
Yeah. The other thing is are you recommending any sort of risk diversification, or what is your analysis based on this first blush of data that we're looking at?
What we're trying to really determine is what exposure, in order to answer that cogent analysis requirement of the board. What is our real exposure to the major industry sectors within the state of Alaska? Tourism, particularly being one of them. Again, going back to the original question that was raised, this is raised in the context of our development of hotel and other facilities like that. We did not have a classification. We did not have the data to say this is the total amount of exposure we have within the tourism sector. So we're still trying to be able to evaluate that and give that information to you about what that exposure is, and then be able to identify the fact that if as an example, of a portfolio that's $420 million, is in excess of $100 million, more than 25%, a high exposure, yes. Does it need to have additional risk mitigation attached with it, or underwriting standards that are attached with it? In my personal view, yes, it does, with that type of exposure. We have what we believe very few that are within that kind of category. And so we're really trying to definitively define the amounts that are within it. We focus on those sectors. We identify with external counsel, in this case consultants that are subject matter experts in those industries, to come back to us and really define how best we should be structuring those loans.
And so that's something you're going to undertake in the coming year?
That is what we will definitively be undertaking. We have given at this point in time notice that we are undertaking that specific review for our hotel exposure to have a better understanding.
And then my other question is, this inflationary environment is not going to go away anytime soon. So what sectors are going to, have we identified what sectors are going to be affected by inflation? Obviously, commercial real estate, but and then also, are we doing anything to mitigate that risk as well?
For the large part, the inflation impact on Alaska's businesses has been fairly elastic, where they've been able to compensate for rising increased costs that are attached with it because of our predominance in resource sectors. Energy, construction, development, the funding that's attached with it, healthcare, as Board Member McKinnon highlighted. So we have largely not seen that broader impact. We have some retail aspects that are certainly impacted by cost increases, but there's limited supply issues and competition that are within the state, yeah, ultimately. So in large part, our analysis has been that there is not a large impact to the state's economy from inflationary pressures. There's the ability to pass that along and recover it. We continue with following all the economic reports that are coming from our broader state organizations, right, on the impacts that are coming to the state. Just trying to identify, we do not see that as a significant exposure right now to be addressing.
Okay. And then,
just very quickly conclude. It does impact our project development, and that has been a different application when we're looking at the construction costs for access road development, retaining other services. We have had to adjust budgets.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, one question I do have. Just on the last page, the shaded green area,
What is that sector? Is
office.
Of office?
Yeah. It's kind of something went over, a percentage went over top of it. But I think it's office.
Oh, okay.
All right, so if I may, for your question, Chair, if I may explain. What we have done is we have provided the NAISC industry code analysis in the chart form. And then we provided what has historically been done on the loan dashboard report. So you see the differences in the industry sectors. Mm-hmm. What the public has attached with the agenda is through November 30th, 2021. We were only able to finalize the updated information that you're viewing through 12/31 as of a couple days ago. So we will also be posting that as well for the public to view the same information. But this is the older, you know, same reporting that's been done, I believe, for the last 10 years on the way the industry sectors have been defined.
Thank you, Alan. Committee members, any other questions on this line item?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Board Member McKinnon. My only other thought is when I look at the earlier chart and look at transportation as a code, in a fuller life, when I reviewed economic opportunities and business readiness, I'm trying to think of the right terminology. Are you open for business? And, you know, national chambers look at which states are most welcoming to business. But when I dug down on some of those surveys, transportation was a key issue that sort of outpriced Alaska on many of our business topics. And I'm just wondering whether we should think about that as we start discussing more where we want to invest in and what we can do. And maybe we leave that to the state of Alaska or local business communities. But as far as how other organizations look at Alaska and whether we're open for business and the cost of doing business, transportation continues to play a key economic driver in making it appear that Alaska may not be welcome for business when it just is transactional costs if you dig down into their surveys further.
Thank you, Anna. Okay. Bill, any other questions or comments?
No, I'm good.
All right, we'll move on to item number 6D. This is Board Member McKinnon's request for potentially looking at allocating a portion of our investment portfolio for higher risk, innovative, strategic initiatives. We have also referred to this before as angel fund investments.
And Chair, if I may summarize what we have attached to the agenda.
Yep. Thank you.
This was an analysis that had been provided with the investment policy. That is a proposal, ultimately, from staff. It's meant to be a guideline for the conversation. Really, we're looking for feedback from yourselves on what it is that you want us to be fully reviewing. If what's being presented in the, what's titled here, the Entrepreneur Venture-Based Economic Development Fund, you know, it doesn't meet those requirements. We're really looking for feedback on what it is that you would like us to be focusing on. What is it that we haven't allocated over here? Because there is the same, I would say, a common view among staff and certainly the board discussions that if we can appropriately define risk parameters for earlier stage development on what our particular view is strategic initiatives within the state, then there are specific economic development benefits that come from that, quantifiable, tangible economic development benefits that could come, and the state should be focused on that.
Thank you, Alan. Board Member McKinnon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, first I'd like to correct the record that I believe the board at our strategic planning session almost 2 years ago or a year and a half ago brought up the concept during discussions about risk management on our entire portfolio. And one of the conversations that evolved or has been evolving is this idea that data, should we want to look at more of an entrepreneur business, should establish some risk measures to make sure that our portfolio is not negatively affected by these high risk, from my perspective, venture-based opportunities. And so, Mr. Chairman, you've referred to angel funding, and that's how you've talked about it. I've talked about it from my experience when I served on Alaska's Renewable Energy Advisory Board, and they had a category called Emerging Technology, and they allocated a small percent from the Renewable Energy Fund for emerging technology to limit their risk. And so, Alan, that's what my comments as one board member have been structured from. It is what I consider a very successful way to mitigate risk that AEA had done over in that fund. And so there's a structure that's built over in AEA regarding this emerging technology. And I'm not sure if this particular project that I'm going to highlight speaks to it, but as an example, in-river renewable energy was one of those emerging technologies, and all emerging technologies are not going to be successful. This type of investment is risky, and you could probably speak more to it than I can about whether 1 in 10 is going to be successful or not, but it's the reason why should ADA want to create a pot of money for what I consider emerging businesses that might benefit Alaskans. We need to very carefully enter that market, and we need to have safeguards around our portfolio so that one player or a group of players does not adversely impact any group, any future boards of trying to do something unique for Alaskans. So that's where it was coming from for me, is over at the renewable energy and looking at that emerging technology and how that fund has managed that. I'm also supportive of a specific amount versus just jumping unabashed into a pool and creating our entire portfolio for this type of investment. I think that would be high risk and unadvisable.
Agreed. Bill, any comments?
No, I just like the basic idea and look forward to future discussion about how we may approach this. Looks like it's just in the beginning stages, and it'll take a little bit of shaping and seeing if we even want to get in there. But venture-based capital, I think, is one of ADA's missions, part of ADA's mission. So I look forward to it.
Alan, I do like your proposal here, and setting that limit on basically, say, 1% of our total portfolio. Would there come a higher interest rate with these types of investments?
The traditional form, when you talk about this earlier stage investment, is in equity or quasi-equity-like instruments. So it's really evaluating it from the total return that's achieved from a portfolio. And you do have a higher requirement for this earlier stage type investment. A large part is how you ultimately end up structuring that quasi-equity, equity investment. And Morgan, you want to give some background?
Sure. It can take the form of more of a hybrid approach, where it's equity or equity-like with a debt-type structure in order to help mitigate the risk component that ADA would be taking with this capital. But it's also important to look at what we would be viewing in these situations as to that multiplier effect, because it's not only just that return of capital, it's that double bottom line that we're really looking at. And so we would be focusing on emerging technologies or industries that could offer further diversification, how it could further build out additional support businesses through vendor-based or through other support-type structures. And so there would be a massive comprehensive review, not only about the return aspect of it, obviously, from the capital standpoint, but what can those emerging or venture-based companies do in the grand scheme and for the entire state of Alaska as it becomes successful, and how can that multiplier effect really affect all communities and the state at the same time.
Is equity something that Ada would want?
We have very broad statutes, the way that our various means of finance and investment tools have been written. So from our analysis with Ada statutes, our definitions of projects, the way that we have funds that are available, we can fit in a program that we would propose ultimately to the board with some parameters that are attached with it. The same way that we've approached, as an example, the AK SHIP program under the Economic Development Account as a specific defined pilot program, pool of assets, specific parameters of investment that are attached with it, defining the type of emerging technology, to use a board member McKinnon's identification, that we would be looking for that meet our mission, ultimately as our powers and authorities as defined under our statutes. So we have the mission for job growth and economic diversification within Alaska. What you're talking about is establishing a program with our funds that is, these would not be directly tangible job growth from the direct investment. It would be looking at the future opportunity of job growth and economic diversification for the state. So it would meet our statutes on powers and authorities as well.
Okay. So would we go as far as, like, some angel investors, they'll come in, equity participation up to 55%, but and they control the checkbook. Would we get in that deep?
Go ahead. It would all depend on how the staff and the board end up wanting to outline and draft the program. We want to be in a position to constantly promote the development and success. This is just a comment. If you're investing behind an entrepreneur or venture company, you're investing that you believe that they are going to be able to succeed. Not necessarily do we want to control the outcome of that, but you want to be in a position where you're monitoring, because again, it is our capital that would be deployed, and you want to make sure that we're upholding and making sure that they're being good stewards of that capital and fulfilling on what they ultimately propose to Ada in their growth plan.
So basically a case-by-case basis.
Correct.
Now, I would be supportive, this is just myself, but I would be supportive of bringing this proposal to the board.
Yeah.
Anna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Board Member McKinnon here. So, for clarity, Alan, we're talking about staff is recommending a weighted percent of total assets, and that could be changed. Is that correct? And right now, that's between 1 and 1.25% of total assets as one strategy?
Well, if I may give some clarification on that, the answer, short answer is yes. The clarification, though, is that what we've defined it is what is our consistent income, right? New capital returns that are coming to Ada that is not otherwise obligated for a dividend distribution or to be determined as a dividend distribution to the state. So if we're consistently earning a certain amount, and then we look at our financial statements, we can identify that in a normal year, outside of COVID, as we've been impacted for fiscal 2020 and 2021, we know that there is normally a level of $30 million in statutory net income that's available. So looking at what otherwise would be distributed, we would designate a level of funding initially for this program in the range of $15 million, at least under a proposal, and it can be modified as needed. But we would look to manage this in a way of broadest level of diversification within it. So not all the $15 million being expended into one potential opportunity. It's managing it as a broader portfolio. Organizationally, what we would do, Morgan Neff, as our Chief Investment Officer, has background information in these kinds of investments. We have the experience with current staff within the organization. We're looking at adding individuals and supporting the chief investment officer who also has experience in early stage, these kind of early stage investments. So we believe we have the capacity to adequately manage this, to present the full risk issues to the board in the way that we would go forward. I'm sorry, Ms. McKinnon, does that address your question?
I'm just trying to provide clarity for the record and the public. I have the document that has been provided to the public in front of me, and so what you're speaking to is a five-year average for ADA's historical statutory net income as providing one way to mitigate risk if we were to venture this direction. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct. It's proposed this way to where we're identifying that our core asset base would not be exposed based upon what's being proposed for this early stage investment.
And then staff is proposing, or at least for discussion sake, looking at single user exposure limitations as well. Can you talk to how we would limit single user so we have an entrepreneur that comes to us? I think it's the only page that I have, or it's page two. Page two is what I'm looking at. So first we talked about portfolio weighting, and then the next subtitle is single company limitations. So can you speak to staff's recommendation to reduce exposure by a single company?
Morgan, I think you could address that.
Sure. The original idea behind the limitation there was to at least offer enough bandwidth to get behind a company that potentially would have a larger investment need than a couple hundred thousand to 500,000 that staff and the board would really be able to get behind. These are just suggestions and guidelines that we would love to have a discussion with the board about, but it gives an opportunity for it to be diversified because, again, you're maxing it out at potentially half of what is available to distribute, which would be really in a very rare situation where you would have an opportunity that would require that level of funding, but it would provide not only the rate of return, the risk mitigation, but also the multiplier effect to substantiate that level of capital investment. But, again, it is just an outline of where we could be having a discussion on setting those limitations.
So if one user came in as a hypothetical and we use the current five-year rolling average from 2016 to 2020 experiences, a single user could qualify for up to $7 million. Did I get that right for simple math?
For simple math, yes, ma'am. And again, this isn't a formal proposal, but it is just an outline. And then what you could do is potentially drop down at that point to then limit each individual investment to a much lower substantial value in order to provide more diversification for that capital.
So then if I could, Mr. Chairman, Morgan, if we were doing a one-time investment for venture capital, and this is for your consideration and exploration with the team, I'm concerned that that cap is too high, that one person would take 50%, because then if there were, depending on the response that we got as an organization, it would really limit our availability to get into very many ventures, and I'm wondering what this multi-year opportunity would do to ADA. So we could start risking more of our portfolio on single user if we allow multiple years, or if we didn't have that, we could be into somebody for $15-20 million that they would just keep coming back every year if they were the only person going into the angel fund. I don't know what past experiences have been, if it's one and done, or if folks stay in for the long term. And this has been successful over at the Permanent Fund Corporation. I know that there's been some incredible amounts of money made by in early technology on as an example from medical facilities.
Yes. No, your points are well taken. And as far as the limitations go, this was an effort to get this type of conversation rolling and for the board to provide feedback on their comfort and where they thought the limitations and exposure should be. So I do appreciate that. And if you would like us to, and I would love to be able to come back to you and provide a little bit more, call it granular standards or limitations that you have suggested just now.
Morgan, I think this is close to the end for me. Is 10% a norm for voting equity? It seems to me that if we were going to look at this and folks wanted cash, then we certainly should get a percentage return on our interest rate. But if we're accepting, or if Alaska were to accept voting equity in a company to make them I guess so that they can pursue the opportunity is the best way to say that. It, as Alan said, we would expect more return and not getting any capital, any dollar returns for Alaskans, right? And so I would like to see something that has alternate courses of action for an entrepreneur so that ADA does not stymie the project and could be a partner with how we want to participate in something like this. Does that make sense?
Yes, ma'am. And there's other avenues for other parts of the capital structure that we could be participating in. I think there's sometimes a misconception that the more equity you own over the company, the more you're reducing your risk. And I would argue that honestly, there's times where the more equity you're owning, and if you're perceived as in a controlled position, you're actually opening yourself up to much more risk in a lot different of ways outside of just capital impairment. So the 10% common equity or the voting side was a limitation to really make sure we're not stepping into a position that could potentially harm ADA more than our capital base would be, as far as, potential issues with being in the control position. So there's other ways to invest capital within these situations in a venture or entrepreneurial way that doesn't really put us in a more voting position or control position, but gets us that rate of return and effectuates the mission behind ADA's capital as well.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one more, and I thought about this earlier, Morgan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Liability. So ADA has larger pockets and a healthy balance sheet, and so how inside of these types of relationships do we protect ourselves if we're taking an ownership interest so that we don't, so that we're not the last man standing on a bad project?
Absolutely. It's all about the underwriting, the strict underwriting that would be required in order to move forward with an investment underneath this program. And then working with external counsel in order to make sure the documentation, the rights, and the agreements that were associated with our capital were in the benefit of ADA, as well as not prohibiting the growth of the company that we're trying to support.
So I think this is the first blush of this type of arrangement. And so, Alan, how do you want to move forward to progress this to the board?
Well, I would then suggest that if the basic parameters on what we're discussing here meet what you have been looking for, in us defining some fund capacity for early stage investment, that we advance it to a proposal, fully fleshing out ultimately what type of terms that we would attach to it, and a fundamental term sheet that would be the program's parameters.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would hope that, Morgan, you'll work with Board Member McKinnon to address some of her concerns as you're drafting that proposal.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Good, Dan? Is that a good path forward?
Do we just need to protect the public?
Yes.
Protect ourselves? Yep, thank you.
Thank you very much. We have about 30 minutes left. I know that we both have
at least myself and Bill have hard stops at noon. So the next two items I'd like to spend about 10 minutes on each and then leave some time for some questions and board comments. The next item on the agenda is 6E. The reason that I bring up this item on the agenda is I'd like to understand the loan underwriting process. And for me, I would like to, my big concern is the differentiation between who's underwriting the loan and who approves the loan. And I want to make sure that those are two different groups. There's a lot to be invested when you're underwriting it. You're putting it all together. It's your proposal. But I hope there's a separate set of eyes that are in the approval process. So I don't know if Alan or Tiffany or Morgan, who's going to sort of just high level walk us through the underwriting to approval process. I know the ultimate is the board at some points, but maybe give us the progress of the underwriting process for AIDA.
Sure. What I would like to do is give you the overview of our internal process before you see it ultimately coming to the board level.
Mm-hmm.
And then if there's any questions individually, we have Tiffany that can address the underwriting, what she does at a ground level with the applications that come through for the commercial finance area, and then Morgan can identify for the direct project finance.
Yeah. And I'm going to keep this section all to 10 minutes, so as brief as possible.
It's very simple and very straightforward, is that if an application ultimately comes through, depending upon the program that the application is related to, that staff will do the review and engagement with either the borrower directly, if it's a direct project finance loan, or with the underwriting bank in the process with the loan participation program.
And we have guidelines in place already on our application, what is needed to support that application.
That is by regulations and statutes that's defined within our regulations, except what information is reviewed.
Good. Okay.
That has been prepared, and a proposal is made to internally. What we have every week is staff investment committee. That investment committee is made up of myself, Morgan, Dave Heimke is our chief operating officer, Donna Keppers is our chief financial officer, and Tiffany Jansen participates from the commercial finance.
So who receives the application? Is that Tiffany or?
It's a loan participation program. It will go to her group for review. It's then her responsibility to present it to the investment committee. She does not vote on that.
She does not vote.
No. Okay. If something was being presented ultimately for a direct project finance loan, then the underlying loan officer or investment officer, or Morgan in that case, would be preparing the information for presentation to the investment committee, and they do not vote on that.
But Tiffany would have a vote in that.
So she would have input on that information, technically not a vote.
Okay.
If it's approved ultimately by the investment committee, then it is either based upon our policies and procedures, either directly undertaken by AIDA. If it's below $3 million, it doesn't go to the board under a loan participation program. Everything under our direct project financings comes to the board. So even if it's $2 that's being asked, not to say we receive applications for that, but as an example, if that was to be undertaken under any of our programs, under our economic development account or sets or the Arctic Infrastructure Development, that needs to then go to be presented to the board. So the investment committee is the first review, set of eyes and vote, and then it's depending upon our policies, procedures, regulations, it comes to the board.
Thank you. That's what I was hoping for. I wanted to see that there was some separation between the underwriting process and the approval process, and it definitely sounds like there is.
What we want is, from the standpoint of approach of staff, is we want responsiveness, we want advocacy, but we want responsibility and accountability that's also attached with the underwriting. I think it's worth understanding from Tiffany what her and her team do in the underwriting before it even comes to the investment committee, because there's a large amount of analysis and undertaking that's done at that stage.
Sure. Thank you, Alan. Yes, Chairman. So I want to reference back to a memorandum that was done, I think, as part of the modifications of July 15, 2020, where there was a detailed list given of all the things that we need to look at when we underwrite. So also the regulations. There you go. So the regulations also go into that as far as tax returns and background information and a write-up from the lender and all of that. So when we get it, it actually comes in through a general email, commercial finance email, so we make sure that it's received to the group instead of to a person. And then I will look at it and assign it out. So assign it out at our meeting. The loan officers or myself will go back and forth as far as them writing up the credit memo, comes to me, make revisions, edit it, ask these questions, go back. So that's a back and forth process. Depending on how long it takes for the borrower or the lender to provide that information. And then I will present it to investment committee. So investment committee gets notification 2 days out to be able to review that information and go over that. So our aim and our internal procedure is 5 days from the time that we receive a complete package to the time that it is done and to me for revisions and either approval to get to the next level or to go back for different conditions being met.
And does Alan, Dave, Morgan, or Donna have any input on that loan application before it gets to the investment committee?
So if it is of a board level, what we have done is bring that even at the pre-flight stage to Alan to discuss. To see what we want to state at that time. Do we want certain conditions to be met, certain parts of the project to be emphasized so that we understand better what's going on?
So if I can highlight a couple of things that she said that are changes in procedures from previous management oversight of that loan participation program is Tiffany is definitely looking for feedback internally on particular issues that she wants to be aware of have been raised by the board previously. The element of environmental reviews that were necessary required at different facilities is one topic of conversation. The level of collateral that's being provided, different, you know, guarantor structures, situations. She's asking questions on that we're giving feedback to. But she ultimately is looking at the information as it's coming in, taking her experience in underwriting bank facilities, very similar to this, what we do, and then really giving that response back to the underwriting banks on what those requirements are. And if she believes at that point that it's ready for presentation, she provides us in full detail, and we have a robust discussion in the investment committee about each and every one of those loan applications that come through.
Good.
And I would say there's been a broader share of information, financial information, business plan, follow-up on those particular issues, than I have historically seen in the program.
Excellent. Anna or Bill, do you have any questions regarding the underwriting process?
No, I'm good.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Tiffany.
Did you have any questions on with the direct project finance loans? That is a different process than what we have with loan participation program.
Well, I'm assuming the same type of process is occurring.
Yes, but since we don't have a bank that's, you know, originating a loan and providing us with, you know, essentially a lot of the pre-flight information, we are essentially master of our domain there. And as Alan has put it, we're constantly striving to know what we don't know because these are, well, at times and most of the time, much larger capital investments directly with the company. And we're looking at a more, you know, a full comprehensive approach to the organization. One of the things that we're adding in our underwriting process because of the exemption to our tax exemption is all term sheets and all either modifications going forward are including a provision for them to allocate their property taxes into a reserve account. Because in the event that we ever have to, you know, take action on that, ADA's tax exemption no longer applies on foreclosed real estate. And so for ADA to mitigate that going forward and not to have to pay for past liabilities or to be looked upon as someone to absorb those liabilities as a company starts to falter, we are taking proactive stance to enhance our due diligence and underwriting process in our agreements.
I appreciate that. Morgan, my focus is more on the process.
Mm-hmm.
And making sure that there's controls
And for direct loans, I imagine that you and Alan are pretty heavily invested in that underwriting process.
Ed, you know, honestly, Alan really looks at his team in order to provide the analysis and the input needed, and then he views it as part of the investment committee, and he does a very good job at reviewing it and providing great questions and feedback.
Certainly.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, certainly.
Yeah, so when we get to a point where we believe that an opportunity is prime for a potential inclusion as a direct investment, me and my team will work it up, go through the due diligence process, and only at that point, until we feel it is absolutely fully baked from an underwriting and due diligence standpoint, and we are still comfortable with moving forward with it as a proposal, does Alan really see it. Now, he may be aware of it because it's in our pipeline, but as far as the granularity of where, what the underlying business is or what we're looking at, he really does provide a lot of autonomy and allows his staff to perform and operate under the skill set that we have attained over decades of experience.
Alan, do you think that the investment committee should be expanded to some folks that are completely outside of the process? So, for instance, like what Morgan just mentioned, they bring it to you beforehand just to take a look at it. Maybe there are some additional things that you need to look at. What I'm concerned about is I just want to make sure that there's people that are on that investment committee that they're coming into it fresh and not having any knowledge prior hand about it and trying to maybe, I'm not saying that you do this, but trying to make sure that something gets across the finish line. You feel like you have an ownership in it. Do you think that it should be expanded?
I only can answer that question from my own experience.
Yeah.
So I've been in.
And I guess it's not just you; it's any future.
I've had 25 years of banking, underwriting experience, and project development, infrastructure development. I participated on different loan committees within LaSalle National Bank, which was a large mid-market underwriting bank in Chicago. So we saw much higher volumes of loans that were coming through on that. I was on other loan committees in that. It's very rare that you have people that are external that are to it. What you benefit from is having people with the right experience base that are having the direct responsibility to the loans itself, and have that also people around the table that have the feedback and able to guide it the right way that needs to go. That, I think, is the most effective contribution to it. If you're asking me, I believe we have that established at this stage with our investment committee. We have different viewpoints around the table, which is always beneficial. It gets to the issue that Morgan highlighted of being able to ask what is it that we don't know. Because
right.
You can come to something with a preconception about what the particular issue is and just drive it that way and maybe miss what the particular exposure or risk is. So we have a party like Dave Heineke with his experience and Eliezka from an operational standpoint asking some very specific questions about, in one case, I do recall an environmental question that was raised on building standards in Tundra that became pertinent for the underwriting and did impact that. We have feedback that's coming from Donna, who has a different experience set on we're having working at Alaska, but also with Department of Revenue and some other oil and gas tax underwriting. So you get that type of perspective that comes from it. You have a mix, I believe, that's already established around the table. So in my opinion, I think we're actually addressing it very well.
Great. That's what I wanted to hear. Thank you. Any other questions on this topic? All right, moving on to 6F, the process of foreclosure and related communications actions and notices. We've had to go through a foreclosure, unfortunately, with one of our partners. I don't know, has Ada ever had to do a foreclosure prior to this?
I believe that during certain spans of our economy in the 80s, we have.
Yeah.
Certainly within the last 10 years, no.
Yeah.
There's been very limited exposure losses, REOs, you know, they're real estate owned,
yeah,
within the loan participation program, but there have been occurrences, not significant from the standpoint of our total portfolio, but there have been occurrences.
And this was really item that came up at the request of Chairman Cruz. So just maybe if you could walk us through very briefly some of the processes that you have for foreclosure, what we're doing internally at ADA and who's managing those projects.
I think the best resource in really defining this is our service agreement. Again, if we're talking about the impact of our loan participation program, we have service agreements in place with the underwriters of the loans themselves who have then sold that loan portion of it to us. So, Tiffany, if you could explain what occurs under the service agreement in this particular case.
Absolutely. So it's very clearly defined the process that we can take and that the originator needs to take in the event of a default of the borrower. So it's in Article 6 of all of our service agreements, which are essentially the same. They have 30 days to notify us, and then we have to work together to determine a further course of action, whether we're going to sell it, whether we're going to work with the borrower further, what we're going to do with it. And in the event that the originator and the authority cannot agree, then it's determined those with the owner of the greater rateable interest, which is always us, we're at least 75 to 90% of the participation on that loan, that then we would determine the course of action to be taken.
And you're the one managing that, or who's managing that internally?
Well, we have not had one get to that point, obviously, but that is something where I would bring it up with Morgan or Alan well before, as soon as we get notification of anything. I'm very quick on the draw to let them know, hey, we think this might happen in the future, even before we get anything like this, because we'll see that typically in the payments received or not received, right, or that they're coming later and later. So that is where we've already reached out to the lender to discuss kind of what's going on, because we do have a couple of loans that habitually jump in and out. So we're very well aware of that story before it gets to this point.
So Morgan or Alan, currently, who is managing our current foreclosure?
It would be a combination of myself and Tiffany. My background in restructuring is pertinent to the situation, and then it's a collaborative effort also with the investment committee.
So at the end of the day, you're responsible.
I'm co-responsible. You know, I'm responsible because I step in because of my skill set, but then it ultimately goes to the investment committee for review, and then through to the board for review as well.
Chair, this is one of the reasons why we concentrated the old management oversight of the loan programs together, because this is a common issue. It's a common issue within Alaska when we're looking at our specific assets, because that's our only field of investment. So what we have unfortunately gained some level of expertise in the process with our larger North Slope investment in oil and gas, we are able to apply that in application if the occurrence happened on that portfolio. And as you're aware, in a couple cases, we also engage external legal counsel. We also engage other forms of counsel in order to address what restructurings may be related to some elements of that program, our loans outstanding. So when we are aware of a situation that's going on, because we do closely monitor the ones that have been identified as needing additional monitoring, we do discuss that. We identify what counsel we need to start giving some preliminary information on ultimately how we address, be it another request and a modification, be it another new request by that borrower, be it a rate adjustment that's been requested that comes in. We address all that with that view of how do we make sure that ADA's capital is protected, is addressed most efficiently.
And do any of the committee members have any questions for staff? All right. Well, in the interest of time, I would like to move on with the committee's approval.
Yeah.
Thank you all for all the information you gave today. I think it's very important for the public to understand what is going on at ADA and our thought processes behind it, which is why I've really convened a lot of this today to talk about, because we haven't had this type of discussion. We've been very reactive and not really proactive in alerting the public of our thought process behind the scenes. So I appreciate everything you did today. With that, I'll move on to board comments. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Board Member McKinnon here. I just want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for keeping us on time and on focus. I'd like to thank staff for providing us information on applying criteria to help mitigate risk in our portfolio. My last comments on item 6D, as it relates to possible investment or creation of some kind of venture fund, angel fund as you referred to it, emerging technology, was my experience with this over at AEA. I would say that all requests would come before the board and that would not be a staff decision to invest in as a possible criteria. Maybe staff is already thinking about that. And then access to information if we were to take shareholder interest in something, if that's possible. With that, I appreciate the robust discussion and the consideration of trying to provide for the people of Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Anna. And our new committee member, Bill Kendi.
Well, nice meeting up.
To the committee.
I want to compliment staff on this, so, as always, on the information provided. And the comments I was making earlier about the 90 days and what flexible, that's no reflection on this staff. But when I first got here, this staff wasn't here. I mean, this is like the dream team. But as the boards changes, so does staff. So I guess what I meant was some guidelines in place for future employment. So, but flexible too, because for instance, say it's Southeast and it's tourism, and we're projecting a record year for 22, but they don't have the staff to be able to handle it. That's an unforeseen issue, and forget whatever we wrote down, you know, put in that kind of caveat. So, you guys are the dream team as far as I'm concerned compared to what I, when I came here in the beginning, it was pretty bad. So, thanks.
Yeah, and I echo all those sentiments. And you know, Alan, I can't sing your praises enough. Appreciate the work that you've done to bring in a good team behind you. So you should be very, very, very proud of what you've done here. One other comment that I think I'll make is to the public is that we had scheduled these budget and audit committee meetings for every other week around the pandemic time because we were facing an unknown foreseen time period where maybe we're going to receive loan modification requests every week. And I think now that, as you can see, our loan modifications have died off as well as the pandemic is sort of, in my opinion, winding down a little bit, I think that we can at least schedule these monthly moving forward instead of every other week.
Yeah.
So we can probably schedule the next BAS meeting, the Budget and Audit Subcommittee meeting, for February.
And maybe just prior to the...
Yeah, that'd be great. Maybe well,
A week.
Yeah. There is some lead time that I think you need for the board meeting. Because if we do approve a loan here, they need some time for the following. But, I think Alan can figure out the scheduling of the